so it's February 14th, 2000, in South Africa. So I'm sure you're all familiar with Descartes, who said, what did he say? I think, therefore I am, right? He was trying to figure out what is the most basic knowledge that we can start with. Because, you know, even the scientists who say we should learn everything by observation, just observe and come to truth, they have to start with something. They have to start with some kind of axiomatic, unproven truth. You can't just start with nothing. So he was thinking, what is the foundation? What is the rock of truth? And that was his conclusion. I exist. And how do I know I exist? Because I can think. That was his conclusion. Now, it's interesting, though, that thinking is not the most elemental aspect of being alive, because there are many living entities whose thinking ability, we could say, is very small. Like the trees. How much are they thinking? Not much. Whether you go by the Bhagavatam or you go by modern science, the trees are not thinking very much. But they are, what? What are they doing?
Existing.
They're existing. They're feeling. They are feeling. They have feelings. So, and even scientific experiments have proven that even plants have feelings. Now, they may be very rudimentary feelings. They may not be very developed feelings, but they have feelings. And Srila Prabhupada talked about this, how one scientist he worked with, Dr. Boyce, did some experiments in India about how plants had feelings. And there's been also experiments done more recently that if you walk into a room of plants and you just think about cutting one of them down or pulling one of them out by the roots, that the plants will start secreting chemicals to protect themselves. They'll pick up on your thoughts. Interesting. So, feelings, desires. Srila Prabhupada says many times that desire is an intrinsic part of a soul. We cannot be alive without desiring. Of course, one could say desires and feelings are somewhat different. The attributes of the subtle body are thinking, feeling, and willing. One could say perhaps that the desires are the willing and the emotions are the feeling. But they're certainly very interchanged. Our desires and our emotions are very connected, aren't they? The things, what we desire is because of some emotion that we have that's indicative of some need of ours. And this is just the nature of the souls, the nature of life. One of the main tenets of our philosophy is that we cannot kill desires and feelings. Now, it's interesting that although we in the Krishna consciousness movement have this as one of our main tenets, very often we find that people trying to practice spiritual life indeed try to do so by killing desires and feelings. Look a little bit about our emotions, material and spiritual, because materially our desires and emotions are very troublesome. Aren't they? Yes. But spiritually, that's what it's all about. Having emotions in relation to Krishna and desires in relation to Krishna. So what to do about this? All right, well, first we're going to look at the nature of this thinking, feeling, and willing business. So you know that we are ourselves a soul and we're covered by a mind that's then further covered by a body. Something like we wear inner clothes and outer clothes. So the mind is like the inner clothes. And the mind, intelligence, and ego, the subtle body, it's made up of something. It has substance. We don't generally think like that. We think, well, the body, the gross body is substantial, but the subtle body is insubstantial. No, the subtle body is also made of substance. Just like sometimes a person is stuck between bodies, like a lift. You call them lifts or elevators here? We call them lifts. I noticed you have some British vocabulary and some American vocabulary and some uniquely South African vocabulary. So, if I say something that you think I've said something really funny, then just ask me, because it's probably some American term that doesn't quite resonate in this part of the world. So anyway, someone who's stuck between bodies, it's like somebody is on a lift between floors and they get stuck in their mental body. That's what we call a ghost. A ghost is there. They're now moving on to the next realm, to the next body. And there are some people who can see ghosts, thankfully. I've never seen a ghost, although I've been aware that there were ghosts in the area. I was in a... In New York, we bought a building that used to be a nursing home for old people. Many people had died there. And long story, but I ended up being in the building by myself for several hours before the devotees had moved into it. Again, so it's a very long story. And I was cleaning one of the apartments there, or flats. I don't know what you call it. Do you call them flats or apartments?
Flats.
Okay, so I was cleaning one of the flats. And while I was doing that, the lift was going up and down by itself, and the windows were opening and closing by themselves. But I didn't actually see any of the ghosts, and they didn't bother me. But people who can see ghosts, what do the ghosts look like? They look like a person, right? They look like that person's gross body did during life. That means, my dear friend, that the subtle body has form. Indeed, this gross body fits over the subtle body, just like we get clothes that fit our gross body. So Krishna explains this in 13th and 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, how we get a gross body that it's fitted around the mind. This is why yam yam vapi smram bhavam tajatam tekalevram tam tam eva tikanteya sadatar bhava bhavita. Whatever you think about, you get. Why? Because that determines the shape of your subtle body. What is the subtle body made of? It's not made of skin and bones and blood and muscles. It's made of what? Thoughts and feelings and desires, thinking, feeling, willing. That's what it's composed of. What we think, what we feel, what we desire, it exists. It's not just some sort of... Actually, it has existence, and it has a particular shape. It takes a particular shape, and it attracts a particular body. In fact, all of the circumstances of this life, the ones we like and the ones we don't like, are the result of our thoughts, feelings, and desires in both previous lives and in this life. We very literally create our own existence. Quite literally. I mean, under Daivanitrena, under the supervision of the Supreme Lord, we can't do it ourselves. Just like little children are given clay by their parents or their teachers, and under the supervision of the adults, they create something. So we don't have the ability as a little soul to put together a body and so forth, but it is put together according to our desires. And this thinking, feeling, and willing, they're a very integrated system. What you think affects what you feel. What you feel affects what you will or what you do, right? If you do things, you tend to think about what you do, and you tend to have emotions in relationship to what you do. And if they're different, they'll tend to pull to be integrated. So if a person is doing things that are different than what they're thinking and feeling, either their actions will come in line with their thoughts and feelings, or their thoughts and feelings will come in line with their actions. Right? It's very hard to stay disintegrated for a very long time. Of course, people who are intentionally disintegrated, we call hypocrites. But it's hard for somebody to remain a hypocrite, whether due to weakness or due to evilness and intention, for a long period of time. Did that make sense? We have a tendency to go towards integration. And the ultimate desiring is coming from the soul. Really, the mind that is undergoing this thinking, feeling, and willing, it is just a machine. Isn't that interesting? We tend to think, first of all, most people think the body is themself, and if a person's a little bit higher than that, then they think the mind is themself. The mind isn't ourself either, it's a machine that's responding to the desires of the soul. It's creating, the mind's creating a world of phantasmagoria, Krishna calls material desires. They come from mental concoction. And the mind's creating under Daivanitrena, under the supervision of the Supreme. Again, we can't do this independently. But it's creating a world of illusion to fulfill the soul's desires. And the mind itself has no life. So our material emotions, material desires, material thoughts are really not ours. They're not really ours. They're ours only by identification. Something like, I mean, the Shastras compare it to a dream. The Shastras compare it to a dream. But the problem with giving the analogy of a dream is that if I dream about you, you don't have that same dream, right? So if I wake up in the morning and I say, I had this dream about you, you say, well, I didn't experience that. So therefore, we conclude that our dreams are unreal. Although when we're having the dream, we are experiencing the thoughts and emotions and activities of the dream as if they are real, correct? Yes? So in that sense, the Shastra compares it to a dream. While we're having it, it seems very real to us. But we have some sense every morning, oh, it wasn't real. Whereas our waking life, we do have a sense. Why do we think our waking life is real? It's longer. We share with other people. Mostly because we get verification. If I say, you know, you came to my house for lunch, you say, yeah, I had a great time. You don't say, well, I was never there. Right? It's a shared dream. So we have some modern technological experiences of shared dreams. One of them is movies. So there's a group of people sitting in a theater watching the movie together. And the movie is an illusion. It's not an illusion in the sense that it doesn't exist. I mean, even dreams exist. They're electrical energy in the brain. You can't say they don't exist. But what they are and what they appear to be are not the same. That's the definition of Maya, that which is not. It's something, but it's not what it appears to be. So the movie exists. What is a movie? You can say, well, it was actors on a set. Of course, that happened in the past. What is it now? It's lights. So it's something, it's lights. But it's not whatever's happening. It's not the person jumping from one roof to another, you know, people getting married, or whatever they're doing, you know, losing their money or fighting. That's not actually what's happening. But the people watching the movie are having a shared experience. And they can talk about it as, oh, did you, this happen, and this, oh, yes, this happened, and this happened. And the people watching the movie, are they experiencing the emotions and desires of the characters in the movie? Yes. In fact, that's why people watch movies. There wouldn't be nobody would watch a movie if they didn't vicariously experience the emotions of the people in the movie. Nobody would go to a movie and just say, oh, that's lights. You know, that would be boring. And even more, our godbrother Sariputta would give the example of a computer game. So even more so, because in the movie, you're identifying with the character just by watching them, but in the game, you actually create your character. Something like, you know, when we were children, we all did that, right? We took some toy, and we pretended the toy was us, and identified with it, and once we grew up, we just couldn't do that anymore, even if we tried. But somehow even adults play these computer games, right? Actually believe that they are this particular, and it's a shared experience where other people are believing that they're other characters, and I haven't played computer games, but I've been around people who play them. And even when they're not playing, they talk to each other as if they're their characters in the game. It's quite interesting. And they'll talk about the things that they've done and that they haven't actually done. And the characters, again, they have feelings and they have desires and they have thoughts. So this material existence is very much like that, except that the illusion is almost complete, whereas people playing a game or watching a movie is not so complete. You have some sense that I'm the person, separate from the game and separate from the movie, right? And eventually you get hungry enough that you have to resume your life outside of the movie or the game, correct? You have to get up and walk away and be who you are. So in the human form of life, also, everybody at least occasionally gets hungry enough and says, wait a minute, you know, this is not satisfying me. But the main point I want to make now is not about being dissatisfied on that level right at this particular moment in my talk. The main point I want to make right now is that these feelings and thoughts and desires that are coming from the mind are not me. They're something created by a machine, just like some machine creates some illusion in a movie or in a game. And we think, these are my thoughts and these are my feelings. This is the situation that I'm in, and this is how I feel about it. So that's material emotions. And what do material emotions do? They drag us to more material emotions, material desires. They drag us to continue in the illusion. Right? They urge you to stay there. And unfortunately, you can't eat the illusory food. You ever tried to eat in a dream? I've eaten in a dream. You know, and I remember one time I had this dream when I was fasting that day, and I took a little rest, and in my dream I was eating. And I kept eating and eating. And at one point in the dream I said, how come I'm not full? So these material emotions, they don't satisfy us. In fact, they embarrass us. Material emotions are very embarrassing. And most human society has a, how should we say, like a code that you're supposed to display as little of emotions as possible. In your regular life, you're supposed to really keep your emotions under control. In fact, it's quite interesting. I've studied some methods of counseling and psychology where people learn how to express their emotions just in words, just to say, you know, I feel really sad, or I feel really confused, or I feel really angry, or I feel really lonely. And just by expressing those emotions, they feel some relief. It's quite interesting. But the other thing you find is that it's very difficult to get people to be willing to even put a word on what they're feeling. I mean, not just going like, I'm angry, but just to say, you know, I'm really angry. Just even say that. Or not to sit and cry, but even just to say, you know, I feel really sad about this. People just don't want to do it. And I thought for a long time, well, why don't we want to do it? Because the emotions are so embarrassing. When we're under the control of the emotions and the desires, well, you just don't know what you're going to do. Right? You lose control. Correct? And therefore, in every civilized society, people are urged not to express their emotions. Which causes all kinds of course, difficulty, because people try to express their emotions without expressing their emotions. And instead of just saying, you know, I'm really worried, they yell at other people and so forth and so on. But it's also very interesting that without emotions, there's no enjoyment. This is our paradox. If you're just thoughts, you know, because emotion and desire is the essence of life. A computer can have thoughts, but a computer can't have emotions and desires. That's the main difference between a machine and a living being. Not I think, therefore I am. I feel, I desire, therefore I am. I have will. So as soon as you try to stop emotions, life is just empty. There's nothing there. You're just a rock. Right? So you have this paradox in human society where people are trained in most societies not to express emotions even by putting names on them. The people, you know, you don't just say, I'm feeling really lonely today. Or even something like, I'm feeling really puzzled, or even I'm feeling really joyous. But at the same time, there has to be some place where people can express emotions, otherwise everybody would go crazy. So then they have some place where what kind of places are people encouraged to express even strong emotions?
Football fields and stadiums.
Yeah, sporting events. I was once staying at the house of one family, and their son was watching a game by himself. He was watching a game on the television. And I walked through the room one time, and he jumps out of his seat and he's yelling at the television. Whoa. So, yes, sporting events. Where else?
Music?
Yes, okay, entertainment. Music, theater, movies, right? Any other places?
Marriage.
Yes, celebrations. Marriages, funerals, birthday parties. Okay, where else?
Hobbies.
Hobbies. Hobbies, sometimes. Usually if it's related to some sport or something like that.
Sport.
Yeah. Do you notice that every human society has its socialized form of intoxication? Mm. You notice that? In every society, there's some sort of intoxicant that is not only legit, but is also encouraged. It's one of the problems you find when you join the Hare Krishna movement if you're still like working in the world. And depending on what society you're in, you know, it might be caffeine, it might be alcohol, it might be something else. Correct? Right? Something. And even in the most stoic societies, like say the Scandinavian countries are very stoic societies, but people regularly get drunk. So they have an outlet for expressing their emotions. So emotions are a really funny thing. Because if you express your emotions, then who knows what you're going to do? You may do something that you'll regret. And if you let your emotions control you. But if you never get to feel your emotions, life isn't worth living. So societies have this sort of funny situation where most of the time you're supposed to just pretend you don't have any emotions or desires. Try to notice to what lengths people go to deny that they have emotions or desires. That their reasons for doing anything are anything to have to do with personal desires or personal emotions. And at the same time, then society has these little windows where you can just sort of explode with emotion and desire. Interesting, isn't it? We just don't know how to deal with these things. Now, of course, spiritually, if you read the Shastra, you read the Bhagavatam, or read Chaitanya Charitamrita, you see that the pure devotees are exploding with emotion and desire. Right? All the time. You know, occasionally you find they also, like when Mahaprabhu saw Ramananda Roy and he saw that there were these persons there who didn't appreciate, then he controlled things to some extent. So what's going on here? What is the difference between material and spiritual emotions? Well, the main difference is that material emotions are coming from the machine. Material emotions and material desires are really coming from the machine. They're not ours. And identifying with them simply pulls us into the illusion, where we're under the control of the three modes of material nature. And we end up acting like fools. Whether ignorant, passionate, or good fools, we still act like fools. And spiritual emotions and spiritual desires are coming from the soul. And the activities of the soul, diving prakriti mashrita, mahatmanas tumam parta, diving prakriti mashrita, are under the control of Srimati Radharani. And anything under the control of Srimati Radharani is lovely. And to be called controlled by her is lovely. To be controlled by Durga Devi is not so lovely. So spiritual emotions are real. They're not from a machine. They're actual. They can actually satisfy. Material emotions cannot satisfy because they're a machine. And they make us do foolish things. Spiritual emotions make us do wise things. Spiritual emotions are part of truth. Material emotions are part of falsity. And being part of a machine, our material emotions are based on, to a large extent, bodily chemicals. Our material emotions and desires, frankly, can generally be correlated to what particular chemicals are circulating in our bloodstream at the moment. Right? How do we feel and desire when we're hungry or when we're tired? And do this way of sexual agitation or something. It's like we're being forced almost. It's like the body forces the mind to do that. So the spiritual emotions are all coming from waves of love. So rasa is also liquid. So, but not this blood liquid. Love liquid. That's cool. Instead of blood liquid, love liquid. That's really cool. I'm going to use that again sometime. So actually, according to Ayurveda, when you eat food, it transforms into rasa also. Rasa is one of the terms in Ayurveda. Yes, you know that you've studied Ayurveda. And that's transported in the blood. Rasa is also liquid. But our material emotions, they're just being, I mean, blood isn't very nice, is it? No. If we saw like a pool of it here, we would feel disgusted. And that's what's the impetus for our material emotions and desires, but the impetus for our spiritual emotions is the rasa of amrita, it's nectar, spiritual nectar, living nectar that's flowing into and through and out of the soul. And what's also quite interesting is that our material emotions and desires are coming from a very peculiar illusion. Not just the general illusion that I'm this body and I'm this person and I have this life and I have and so forth and so on, which is all just a made-up story, like a movie. But also a very deep illusion that I'm empty. Now, how does that illusion happen? So this is nicely explained in the Ishopanishad. Om Purnamada Purnamida Purnat Purnadudachite Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnam Eva Vasishite. That Krishna is complete. Actually, that mantra literally means this is complete, that is complete. If you take the complete away from the complete, still the complete. So many units of completeness come from the complete, and if you take the complete away from the complete, still the complete remains. So we are a complete unit, something like Prabhupada gives the example of a hand. So this is a complete hand, right? Is this a complete hand? Yes? I saw somebody the other day who had a little extra finger. So I don't have any extras and I don't have anything missing. Uh-huh. But if you were to cut this hand off and separate it from the body and you just saw the hand, would you call it a complete hand? Not really. I mean, all the parts would be there, but it couldn't function as a hand. It would have lost its function. It would still have its appearance, but it wouldn't have its function, therefore be incomplete. So although we are complete, we realize our completeness only when we realize our attachment to the complete. Now, we never are actually separated from the complete. Never. We cannot be separated from the complete. That is impossible. But if we want to be separated from the complete, Krishna gives us an illusion of being separated from the complete. And when we have this illusion of being separated from the complete, we feel incomplete. We feel empty. We feel there's something missing. Actually, there is nothing missing. It's just like if you could put some kind of a screen so that you couldn't see the connection anymore. It was still there, but you couldn't see it. Or you put some kind of, you injected some sort of drug so that you couldn't feel the connection anymore, but it was still there. So that's kind of what Krishna has done. Because we wanted him to do it, not because he's mean. So when we're no longer aware of that connection, we feel empty. and we try to connect again. That's what we're trying to do. But instead of trying to connect with Krishna, instead of trying to connect with the arm, we're trying to connect outward with sense objects and with other beings and trying to become complete that way. And all of our material desires and all of our material emotions and our material thoughts also are an attempt to try to attain this completeness through connection, through yoga. But the way we're trying to do it in illusion is kind of on the, you could say, eating. Like we feel empty and we need to eat. So we see all sense objects like that. My ear is empty, it needs to hear. My nose is empty, it needs to smell. My touch is empty, it needs to touch. My sense of desire for love and meaning and peace and what are our other basic needs? Freedom, adventure, are all things to be found outside of it somewhere by grabbing things. And we treat other living entities also, I must say, as food, more or less. More if we're in the mode of ignorance, less if we're in the mode of goodness. But to some extent, we're treating other living entities and everything we're treating as something. If I just keep pulling this in, I'll eventually become complete. But of course, that's not possible. However many things the severed hand grabs while it's severed, it never becomes complete. So material emotions and material desires are all varieties of expressions of incompleteness. They're all different ways of expressing, I want to feel complete by material engagement. And therefore, they're all exploitive. Now, what we learn if we're civilized is that if we just take, eventually we'll be stopped by society. Right? That's called stealing. Stealing is, I take from you, I don't give anything back. Or in Sanskrit, that's called vikarma, sinful activity, I just take. So again, in all civilized human societies, we are trained from a young age. Children naturally just want to take, you know. So we're trained by our parents and by our teachers and our society. No, you can't do that. You have to also give. You have to have an exchange. You cannot just take. So then we come to the platform of karma. Karma is pious activity. I take and I also give. I pay for what I take. But of course, we always want to pay a little less than the worth of what we get. Isn't that interesting? You know, if you go to a shop and you buy things on sale, do you ever feel sorry for the shop owners? Do you ever have any pang of remorse? Do you ever go home and say, you know, I bought this thing for only 20 rand and actually it was worth 100. I feel so sorry for the people running the shop. And we get very upset if the opposite happens. Right? If you pay 100 rand for something and it's only worth 20, then we're furious. And we're not so happy if it's just even, right? You know, we want to get a little, we want the scales to be tipped a little bit. Of course, everybody wants that. And so therefore so much conflict. Like the books they write about relationships, one very famous book, very good book also, by the way. But it writes about how do women keep score and how do men keep score. You know, and each party is thinking, all right, let me get a little bit more than what I'm giving. You know, we're temporarily be willing to give a little more, but we're waiting to push it. We're thinking, okay, I'll give a little more now. Now I better get a little bit more. So that's a little higher level than just stealing, but not much. I mean, it's funny that Krishna tells the gopis that he thinks the merchants are worse than those who have no love at all. So those who are just doing some mercantile exchange. So our material emotions then are involved in that way. And try to notice to what extent our emotions are kindled and inflamed by did I get. And start to notice, it's quite interesting. And, you know, I'm thinking, all right, how am I going to meet my needs? Oh boy, okay, I'm going to meet my needs this way. And if somebody interferes with us, we get very frightened. We get very angry. And if someone appears to be meeting our needs, then we feel happy. That's basically what it's about. Of course, on the highest level of goodness, a person is giving, hoping that their needs are going to be met through salvation. They're not thinking the other jiva is going to meet their needs or the circumstances are going to meet their needs. They're thinking that they're going to get their needs met through salvation. So they're thinking they're going to get their needs met by God, but they're still thinking very selfishly, even in the mode of goodness. So that's why these material emotions are so embarrassing, because our material emotions and material needs reveal to us and to others that what we're really doing is selfishly exploiting. That's why we don't like to admit them. That's why we don't even like to put a name on them. Of course, it's interesting that just by admitting them, one becomes very happy and peaceful. It's quite interesting. Because anytime you get closer to truth, you feel happier. So it's bad enough that we're exploiting, which is false. But if I lie about my exploiting, that's an illusion on top of the illusion. So if one's honest about one's situation, one feels much happier. Isn't that interesting? Because you wonder why psychologically, why is it that if a person just says, instead of yelling at somebody else, if they just say, you know, I'm really sad, that all of a sudden they feel better. Because they're like pulling back one layer of falsity. But again, why don't we want to do it? Because as soon as we do it, we're saying, hey, I'm using you. I'm using you to try to become complete. Now, spiritual emotions are vastly different. Because in spiritual emotions, you're aware, you're constantly aware of your connection with the Supreme Whole. Constantly. You never lose that awareness of that yoga with the Supreme Whole. And the Supreme Whole is not only complete, but he's not statically complete. He's dynamically complete. Like we could fill this cup of water and then it's complete. But with Krishna, he keeps expanding. You know that, right? It's not that Krishna is complete and there's a border. And on the other side of the border is emptiness or something like that. But Krishna just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding and expanding. I mean, that's why David said in the Bible, my cup runneth over. It's like a spring. You know, when they clean out Radha Kund, Shyama Kund, I think they do it every 20 years. So under in the bottom, there's a spring. Then the water just keeps coming and coming and coming and coming. Or like the sun. Krishna's often compared to the sun. The sun doesn't, it just keeps going, right? And how does it do that? It just keeps going. So Krishna's like that, it keeps going, it keeps putting out unlimited light and unlimited energy and unlimited happiness and unlimited, and it just keeps going more and more and more. So if you're in touch with that complete source, you would feel full. Right? And not only full, but you would be overflowing with fullness. That's actually the basis of preaching. I mean, many of us may preach as a means to connect ourselves with Krishna. But ultimately, preaching should be from one who's feeling connected with Krishna and is so overflowing with happiness by being connected to Krishna, they want to give to others. Now, if I'm connected with Krishna and I'm fully satisfied with my connection with Krishna, then all the emotions I'm feeling are emotions of completeness rather than of need. And all of my dealings with others are in the mood of what? Giving. I don't have to bargain with anybody. I don't have to keep score. Because it doesn't matter if you give anything back to me or not. Therefore, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, such a person has no need to depend on any other living being. He said they have no need to do any work, nor do they have a need to stop doing work. And sometimes we see people are afraid to connect with Krishna because they'll think, I've seen this in devotees hundreds of times. They think, if I really connect with Krishna and I'm satisfied, then I'll become irresponsible. I won't take care of my family anymore. I'm won't work anymore. I won't do anything anymore. I'll just sit around and be, I am satisfied. But what they don't realize is that spiritual satisfaction is full of emotion. Therefore, spiritual satisfaction is full of, oh, I want to do this for Krishna. I want to do that for Krishna. I want to do this for Krishna. Right? Prabhupada, speaking on the Brahma Samhita, he says, the devotees have no desires to fulfill, yet they're filled with transcendental desires to satisfy their eternal Lord in loving service. You've all heard that recording, I'm sure, many times. So the devotees, then, they'll take care of their family because it'll make Krishna happy. Not because they're thinking, if I take care of my family, I'll have a place to stay, and I'll have this, and I'll have that. And that way I'll feel complete. So spiritual emotions are coming from an overflowing of satisfaction, an overflowing of completeness, and an expression of fully dynamically met needs, rather than emptiness. There's just never any sense of emptiness. And therefore, they're not at all embarrassing. They're not something that has to be shunned. Because they're not expressions of any kind of exploitation. They're an expression of something wonderful. And as I said, they're actually real. Now, how do we end up experiencing the material emotions? So we do this. This is explained nicely through in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter. This is on your first page, not my second page, your first page. Bottom of your first page. Where Krishna talks about that you contemplate sense objects and then you get attached to them, then you get overwhelmed by lust. Right? And then you get overwhelmed by anger. So as soon as we meditate on this object, this activity, this person, that will meet my needs. That will satisfy me. Then we get attached. I must have this. I must have this relationship with this person. I must have this. And that's all kinds of relationships. I must work for this company. I must keep this job. I must have this romantic relationship. Or whatever it may be. You know, or I must have this object, or I must live in this place, or I must be able to do this activity. And we get attached, and with this attached, our emotions and desires become overwhelming. And then from that leads to frustration and anger. Because unfortunately, when we connect with things, they don't satisfy us. Either we don't get them. Should we play a little game? We have enough time. We'll take a few, just a few minutes. This game was taught to me by Tamal Krishnamar. I play it many places. So I'd like to ask all of you to think about all the material desires you've ever had in your life. Whoa, you know. Like a whole football stadium full, right? So of all the material desires that you had and have, how many of them did you not get in any shape or form? You just didn't get them. You know, you wanted a car, you just didn't get the car. It just didn't happen at all. So what percent of your material desires did you not get fulfilled in any shape or form at all? Anybody want to say? 90%. Oh, sorry. Somebody else? Yes? You, yes, in the green, sorry. What percent did you just not get at all, any shape or form?
Maybe about 30%.
30%, okay. Somebody else? And you there, sir, in the red shirt with the stripes on your shoulders? What percentage did you not get fulfilled at all?
I'd say I've had every percentage fulfilled.
Everything fulfilled, okay. All right, so you've gotten everything you wanted. Anybody else? Some percentage? Shy. Let me turn my pitch on. What about you? What percentage have you not get at all? 80%. Okay. So now I'd like you to take those desires, except for you can't do that because you got out. So take the ones that you just didn't get fulfilled at all, push that off to the side. So now you're left with the material desires that you had, and you got them fulfilled. Okay, now some of those, after you got them fulfilled, you were disappointed. You know, you wanted the new, whatever, DVD player, you got it, and you went, oh, that wasn't what I wanted. I don't do what I like. It's too late to take it back. It was on sale. They won't take it back. I'm stuck with it. Right? So now to think about what percentage of the material desires that you had and got fulfilled were disappointing. So somebody else. So you, people, what percentage of your material desires did you get but were disappointing?
Almost all
90? Okay. And what about you, Vishakapriya? Okay, what about you? What would you say? Yes, you. About 70%? Okay, what about you? About 80%, okay. So now take those and put those aside. So now we're left with the desires that got fulfilled, and they were perfect. Just perfect. So I always use my example that we had this Toyota van. It was great. We bought it used, and it was a refurbished cargo van, and it had seats that would lie down totally flat, so you could sleep in them, but it had plenty of room for luggage in the back, and it had screens in the windows. I noticed you don't have screens in the windows around here, but anyway, we had like mosquito screens so you could sleep like a camper, you know, and the bugs wouldn't bite you, and it got really good petrol mileage, and it would park easily. It was just a great vehicle. Love that vehicle. And one day, my daughter and I were going out shopping, and some young man was late to work, and he didn't stop for the stop sign, and that was the end of my Toyota van. Of all the material desires we have, that get fulfilled and are perfect, how many do we get to keep? Everybody? Zero. Guaranteed. Guarantee you. On this investment, you will make zero. So therefore, we become angry. So we contemplate something, we get attached to it, we lust after it, and then one of three things happen. Either we don't get it at all, and then we become angry. Or we get it, and it's not what we wanted. You know, you thought you married the knight in shining armor on the white horse, and he's some just, you know, fat, balding guy who leaves his dirty socks on the floor. You know, you get it, and it's something different than what you expected. Or you get it, and it's perfect, and you're always afraid you're going to lose it, and eventually you lose it. So this leads to anger. Okay. So this is how our material emotions and our material desires entangle us. And then when we become angry, we lose our intelligence. We forget, I'm a spiritual being. I'm going to get my desires fulfilled in connection with Krishna. And we fall down into material life. Now, what's interesting about this fall-down sequence is this is also how we revive our spiritual emotions. If I contemplate Krishna, and I get attached to Krishna, and I go mad after Krishna, I don't become angry, I become in ecstasy. So it works the same up to a point. Because with Krishna, you do get Krishna, and he is perfect, and he stays there forever. So you get a kind of bewilderment of love, but not a bewilderment that makes one suffer. So we have on your second page, the very end of the page. We're doing this a little out of order, but that's all right. What Prabhupada says in the purport to Bhagavad Gita 13:22, the living entity, if he submits to this hearing process, will lose his long-cherished desire to dominate material nature. And this is the key words, gradually and proportionally, as he reduces his long desire to dominate, he comes to enjoy spiritual happiness. So the concept of the materialists, we already talked about. The materialist concept is, okay, these material emotions and desires are really troublesome, but without them, we have no happiness. So let's kind of keep them controlled most of the time and let them out occasionally and try to let them out and try to make like a safe environment where we can let them out. That's how the materialists do it. And so they're pretty much always frustrated. They're frustrated when they're repressing them, and then they're frustrated when they let them out. Sometimes when they let them out, all kinds of terrible things do happen. So then the impersonalists say, well, since these desires and feelings are the source of our problem, let's kill them. That's their idea. Let's kill them. Actually, I was just reading today in the Bhagavatam where Prabhupada said that the jnanis try to kill the senses of the Lord and the yogis try to kill their own senses. That's quite interesting. So the impersonalist idea is let's just kill it, let's just stop it. And you see that even devotees can go into one of these two things. You know, first of all, we're accustomed to this idea of repression and occasional explosion, because that's how materialistic people live. So we may end up doing the same sort of thing. You know, repressing, 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 and then exploding, and repressing, repressing, expressing, and then exploding. Or we may think, well, the secret is to try to kill. Destroy the self. Don't have any material emotions. Don't have any material desires. Don't have any desires. Don't have any emotions. And you'll find that many times devotees think, well, I can't have any spiritual emotions or spiritual desires until I'm free of material emotions and material desires. So they're thinking, okay, right now my spiritual emotions and desires are very small and my material emotions and desires are very big, so let me first take my material emotions and desires to zero, and then I can awaken my spiritual emotions and desires. That, my dear friends, is called jnana-covered bhakti. We're here, Prabhupada saying, gradually and proportionately. So gradually and proportionately means I do this. As I awaken my spiritual emotions and spiritual desires, my material emotions and my material desires gradually and proportionately decrease. And the way my material emotions and desires decrease is by this awakening of my spiritual emotions. That's our process. Someone asked me the other day in Durban, can I think of Krishna with my materially contaminated mind? Which is a very good question, because that question is also asked in the prayers of the personified Vedas. And I said, well, if you don't do that, how will you purify your mind so that you can think of Krishna? What will be your process? What's your mind purifying process after which you will then think of Krishna? Then you have to look at some other process, like karma yoga or jnana yoga or dhyana yoga. So our mind purifying process, our thinking purifying process, our feeling purifying process, our desire, our willing purifying process is thinking, feeling, willing about Krishna. Even though our thinking, feeling, willing about Krishna in the beginning is mixed. Must be. Has to be. This makes sense to everybody. If you say you can only think and feel and will about Krishna purely, you're not allowed to think, feel, and will about Krishna and contaminate it, then only pure devotees can become pure devotees. You follow? Or you'd have to do something else other than bhakti to purify you first, and then take up bhakti. That was Arjuna's question in the beginning of the 12th chapter. Should I do something else first, and then do bhakti? Krishna said, no, just do bhakti. So bhakti is, you start to develop your spiritual emotions and your spiritual desires, even though at the beginning they're still mixed with material contamination. And you nurture the spiritual part, and the material part will automatically decrease, because you know what? Spiritual emotions and desires and thoughts are wonderful and they're real. They're real and they're overflowing and they're beautiful. They're, how would one say, what's the opposite of being ashamed of something? I think they're glorious. I mean, of course, the devotees, they do try to hide their spiritual emotions in the materially contaminating atmosphere from other materialists. That's a fact. Why? Because the materialists will simply mock them and deride them and deride Krishna. But sometimes even they cannot do so because their emotions are so strong. So that is our process. And I have a little list here, the spiritual emotions, the Vyabhichari Bhav from the Nectar Devotion. You can see the spiritual emotions that the devotees feel in relationship to Krishna. I mean, some of these sound very negative even. Right? We may have this idea that spiritual emotions are all just sort of Shanti. I'm full of bliss and joy. Would you like that? No, I don't think so. So just like I was recently in Dubai, we have a restaurant there, and I'd say it's worth the ticket to Dubai just to go to the restaurant because they make their own ice cream. And they have so many different flavors, and it's made with fresh fruit. So chiku, you know chikus? Do you have chikus here? You get them in India. You don't get chiku here. Oh, don't grow here. Do you get sitapal? Custard apple? You get that, okay. So they have sitapal ice cream, custard apple ice cream, and chiku ice cream, and saffron pistachio. I mean, all different kinds of ice cream. Right? Not just vanilla. So Krishna and his devotees enjoy a variety of emotions. And some of them may seem negative. And we think, well, how is that pleasurable? But even materially, we find pleasure in negative emotions, don't we? Was that a good movie? Oh, it was great! I cried the whole time! Right? People pay money to cry, don't they? Yes? Yes? Actually, in Prabhupada, in his lectures on Nectar Devotion, he talks about how everything we do is trying to enjoy rasa. And the rasas are not just awe and reverence, servitorship, friendship, parental, and conjugal. Rasas are also comedy, astonishment, grief, and ghastliness. Prabhupada says, he says, the murderer is trying to enjoy the ghastly rasa. He said, if you really want to enjoy the ghastly rasa, what form of Krishna should you worship? The same thing. And you can enjoy the ghastly rasa. So it's ghastliness also. The devotees, they enjoy real ghastliness. You know, you can't really enjoy any of those things materially, unfortunately. You're just trying to enjoy reflection, like trying to eat an apple in a mirror. But anyway, the point is that there's variety of rasa, there's variety of enjoyment. And of course, none of them are actually negative. In the material world, even the positive ones are negative. And spiritually, even the negative ones are positive. There's bliss, there's a grief bliss, and there's a ghastly bliss, and there's a scary bliss. Again, we can understand this a little bit. Why do people go on roller coaster rides? They want to be scared. Right? There's some sort of scary happiness. Of course, it's not, it's the machine. And there's a real scary happiness. When Krishna's wrapped up in Kaliya's coils, everybody's scared. But it's a kind of ecstasy. You know, when Indra's pouring the rain. Please don't think that going back to Godhead is just, you know, la-di-da-di-da, it floods. No, there's a flood. And there's, at least in Gokula, and there's monsters. Right? It's excitement. So how are we going to be free of the material emotions? We have to absorb ourselves in the spiritual emotions. We can try to kill it, my dear friends. It won't work. Two things we have no choice about. One, we have to exist, and one, we have to serve. Everything else is a choice, but those two things. And existence means feelings and desires. You cannot kill them. You can try. You know what happens to people who try to kill their desires? Guess what they end up enjoying? Guess what emotions they end up enjoying?
Resentment.
What else? Depression.
Futility.
Hopelessness.
Anxiety.
Anger. People who try to become rocks and generally have a lot of anger. Criticism. Have you ever met rock people? Maybe some of you have experimented with turning into a rock. So if you try to kill your emotions and desires, then you're trying to become a rock. And rocks are still trying to get happiness, rock people. They're still going for Russes. You know, you can't stop it. It just comes out in this really ugly way, you know. I met people like that. And the other thing is, you know, control it, control it, control it. Okay, explode at the football game. And that doesn't work. Neither of those things work. So trying to have, you know, some sort of controlled area of material expression doesn't really satisfy, and killing it doesn't work. So why don't we go for the spiritual? So how are we going to do this? So we're going to do this, of course, by hearing. And when we're reading the books, we shouldn't be reading the books just to read the books, you know, just like, okay, I've read one page. Or just to get into the philosophy in a heady way. Okay, I know the philosophy. I can fill out everything on my Bhakti Shastri test. I mean, that's okay. But that's not really why we're reading. I mean, I'm a Bhakti Shastri teacher. I'm not trying to put down the Bhakti Shastri program, probably one of the Bhakti Shastri program. But it's not that we're reading just so we can fill out an exam. We're reading so we can relish the spiritual. We should be meditating on what we're reading. Yeah. Krishna's in the coils of Kaliya. How long was it? He was there for 2 hours. And I mean, that, Krishna's in, he's experiencing. Entering into that mood. And what we're doing in the course of our devotional service, our chanting, our deity worship, our preaching, anything we're doing, even our so-called material activities, we should be offering them to Krishna with that mood. Even if you're working at a job or you're cleaning your own dishes at home, or devotional service isn't just in the temple. But whatever we're doing, we should be offering to Krishna with some feeling. By meditating on Krishna. And if we do that, how interesting also that those who are overpowered by the spiritual emotions, they're neutral to the material emotions. They're beyond neutrality. The impersonalists think, I'd be happy and peaceful if I could just become neutral to happiness and distress. And Krishna describes those who are, what is his description of those who are overpowered by the spiritual emotions? They're neutral to the material world. They're not affected. Why? Because they have everything. They have everything internally. They're enjoying the pleasure within. So therefore, they can never be a slave anymore to material emotions and material desires. So that's our process. Our process is get the real thing, and then one cannot be a slave anymore to the illusion. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions? Yes?
Can you say something about like when we're growing as a devotee and we're beginning to experience by hearing by the devotees, but we still have strong connection to the material nature. Can you say something about the role of dovetailing what we are in Krishna's?
I actually have a whole seminar in regard that in regard to specifically sex desire. But that's a very good point. Because if you're, let's say, okay, these are our material emotions, our desires, and these are our spiritual emotions. So we're growing them. And let's say we're somewhere around here. By the way, once you get to here, these are no longer very important. When you've just got about this much left, they're still there, but they don't affect you very much. So Prabhupada says it's a hard struggle with determination until nistha or steadiness, and after that things come very easily. So there do get to a tipping point where even though things remain somewhere around here, that they're no longer really troublesome. But the real problem is when you're around here, or here. Because you've still got all this material stuff you've got to deal with. And remember, you can't kill it. Killing it doesn't work. You know, you can try it, but it really won't work. It's not part of the bhakti process, and it's just, you'll get all kinds, you'll get hard-hearted. You'll either get hard-hearted, or you'll have a fall down, right? Or you'll become overwhelmed with anger, etc. So yeah, you have to dovetail it. You have to dovetail our material emotions and our material desires. And that's really the whole idea of Varnashram. I mean, in one sense, Varnashram isn't part of bhakti at all. Varnashram is part of the yoga ladder. Varnashram is the pre-qualification for engaging in karma yoga, which is doing Varnashram for the purpose of purification. But it also works as a very simple way to understand. The reason that we can use Varnashram in bhakti, although it's not exactly a part of bhakti, but the reason why it can help bhakti, although it's not essential for bhakti, is that it gives us a key to how to dovetail. It's, you know, I've really meditated on why take the thousands of occupations in the world and label them in four categories. Why not just label them in 1,000 categories? Because when you label them in four categories, then you say, okay, if you have this kind of emotions and desires, this is the best way to dovetail them. And if you have these, this is the best way to dovetail them, and these, this is the best way to dovetail them. And if I can make a little sociological comment here, I'm a professor of sociology of religion in Radhadash, if I can make a little sociological comment, that ISKCON in the beginning days, we immediately figured out how to dovetail people with Brahminical and Shudra tendencies. Those two were not a problem. So we were able to, if you had Brahminical tendencies, Shudra tendencies, and those desires, that's material, by the way. Being a Brahmin is also material. That we were very easily found a way for a person to dovetail for themselves and a way for them to contribute to the mission of Lord Chaitanya. But if you had Vaishya or Kshatriya tendencies, you were really out of luck. And then somewhere in the late 80s or early 90s, we finally realized that we needed Vaishyas. And those of you who know ISKCON history know why we figured out we needed Vaishyas. I don't know if I want to get into that right now. But we figured that out. And not just Vaishyas who were milking the cows, but Vaishyas generate wealth. And we realized we needed somebody to generate wealth. So all of a sudden we started, validating Vaishyas and giving Vaishyas a place. Oh, you know, you can dovetail your desires and your emotions in Krishna's service. And you can help the mission also. And I would say that we still have not validated Kshatriyas, which is, I see, is causing us two big problems. One on an individual level, that people with Kshatriya tendencies haven't the foggiest notion of how to dovetail their propensities in Krishna's service, and a lot of them cause a lot of trouble. Well, because that's what Krishna said would happen. He said that if you either have to use your propensities for me or for Maya. If you use them for me, you'll be happy. If you use them for Maya, you'll get into trouble. And so I would say that a lot of the people who cause trouble are frustrated Kshatriyas. Because Kshatriyas, what are they into? Well, first of all, they like to fight. You know, like that Bomasuri, he had no one to fight with. He was fighting with the mountains. You know what you fight with? You may fight with the other devotees. Whatever. And also Kshatriyas are very much into ethics and morality. By the way, Brahmins are not. Brahmins are not very much into ethics and morality. They're into forgiveness. You have a society run by Brahmins, there's not a whole lot of justice. There isn't. There isn't a whole lot of justice. There isn't even necessarily very high mundane ethics. There isn't. They're not particularly interested in them. Brahmins are interested in liberation and transcendence. They're personally ethical, but they're not really interested in establishing an ethical society. They're very forgiving and tolerant. Kshatriyas are not. They're not forgiving and tolerant. I mean, sometimes, but not generally. And they're really into justice and ethics. And it's the big thing we're missing, I'm sorry to say. It's quite obvious. And those who are Kshatriyas, really, they more than anyone else notice that it's missing, and they make a big clamor about it. and fight a lot about it. So it's a real problem for our mission in general. Also, you can't establish society without sutras. It's impossible. You just can't do it. And Prabhupada said Varnashram is to be established by the government. But Brahmins cannot establish Varnashram. They can preach about it, and they can give models for it, but they can't establish it. Only the government, Kshatriyas means government, can establish it. And if we're going to have a society, we're coming up to, in 2016, the 50th anniversary of the founding of ISKCON. And I'd say we've done really good on the IKCON. We have a very nice international Krishna consciousness. We've done quite well with that. But we haven't really done very well to form a society. I mean, we formed a society in the sense that we're a group of people who get together, but as far as actually the sort of society Srila Prabhupada talked about, where there would be villages and, if you're going to make the world Krishna conscious, but we haven't yet done that. So those of you who are Kshatriya tendencies, it may be a little difficult. And what I see the devotees who are Kshatriyas do, either they try to pretend to be Brahmanas, which doesn't work very well, because then they fight with the other Brahmanas, or they pretend to be Vaishyas, which doesn't, again, work very well. And Kshatriyas don't generate wealth. They collect and redistribute it. It's quite different from generating it. We have a few leaders in ISKCON who are acting as Kshatriyas and doing a good job of it and doing well, a few. And others end up doing things sort of parallel to ISKCON. So I've seen a number of devotees who set up their own projects because Kshatriyas also are engaged in welfare work. They like to open schools and they like to open hospitals and they like to feed people, and that's what they like to do. And if they try to do that in ISKCON, somebody criticizes them and says, well, you're doing social welfare work in ISKCON and you shouldn't be doing that. So I do see that Kshatriyas have a little bit of a hard time dovetailing their emotions and desires and service right now, and I assume that in the next 10, 20 years that will change. It is changing. I know of key persons in various parts of the world who are definitely Kshatriyas and who are figuring this out and who are working on actually building society. But so one way we dovetail our desires is through the Varnas, that you figure out what is my psychology, how do I feel fulfilled in the world, and then you see, okay, what's the process according to the Shastra of how I can feel fulfilled in a way that can be used in Krishna's service. And there are these broad categories, four broad categories into which you can fit different people's inclination. Basically, if you want to protect truth and knowledge, or you want to protect people, or you want to protect animals and natural resources, or you want to protect arts and skills. So depending on which area you want to you enjoy, that's the area you then protect for Krishna. That you develop the arts and skills as devotional offerings. And you keep, like, now we have factory-made clothing, factory-made machines, things made by hand. Or you protect the natural resources and the animals, or you protect the people, or you protect truth and knowledge. Then the other area of dovetailing, of course, is the ashrams. And the ashrams are a little different in that they are mostly by age. So generally, when you're very young, you're a student. When you're in youth, you're married. When you're in middle-aged, you're retired. And when you're in old-aged, you're renounced, generally. Although some people can be renounced whole life. So that also is you looking at what are my particular emotions and desires. We should also note that the Varnas apply almost exclusively to the Grihastha ashram. So those in the renounced ashram, because Varnas are how you make your livelihood also. So those in the renounced ashram are not supposed to be making a livelihood. And therefore, there's not nearly as much scope for dovetailing one's psychological propensities and one's desires in the Brahmachari Vanaprastha or Sannyas ashram as there are in the Grihastha ashram. So if a person feels they really have a lot of things that they want to do and different desires, the Grihastha ashram is the best place for such a person, because that's a legitimate place to dovetail your desires. And basically, the main desire of the Grihastha ashram is for security and control, and obviously some more sense gratification. For the Renounced ashram, the main desire is for freedom. And the Brahmachari ashram, the main desire is for study. We should also note that there's a difference between being a Brahmachari lifelong and being in the Brahmachari ashram lifelong. So generally, Brahmachari ashram should be maximum age 24, 25. And after that, one should enter into the Grahastha Vanaprastha or Sannyas Ashram. Prabhupada says Brahmacharya Ashram is training for the detached and the unattached. So if we look at exactly, and I don't have time tonight to get into this in detail, but if we look at, it's a very scientific system. And basically all this material stuff over here, all this material emotions and desires, we have different flavors of it. Some people have the renounced flavor, some people have the grahastha flavor, some people have the brahmana flavor, some people have the kshatriya flavor, right? And then there's varieties within that. And then there's a whole science in the shastra, okay, this is your flavor, you know. And that can change during your life too. So you change, most people anyway are supposed to change from the grahastha ashram to the renounced ashram later in life. And most people are supposed to change from the renounced ashram to the grahastha ashram back to the renounced ashram. And each way, there's a way of dovetailing your desires. There's a way of doing it so that the material side of your emotions and the material side of your desires isn't troublesome for you, and they act, they give you an effect almost as the pure spiritual emotions and desires do. So we compare that to the hot iron rod put into the fire. The fire is fire, but the rod put into the fire acts like fire. It's still iron, and as soon as you take it out of the fire, it'll be iron again. It doesn't really become fire, but its action is like fire. So Bhaktisiddhanta calls these gunadharma, or subsidiary functions, that can help in bhakti. Again, like, you know, most of us don't put iron rods in the fire, but we put pots on fire, right? And the pot gets as hot as the fire. So if you're engaged in the main activities of bhakti and if you're developing your spiritual emotions, that gives you the fire. You can't dovetail your material emotions. You can't fireize your material stuff unless you've got a fire. You know, you can't just dovetail the material. That's why we're not interested in varnashram as varnashram at all. We shouldn't be anyway. That's a preliminary prerequisite for karma yoga and gyan yoga, which we're not interested in, I hope. So we should have zero interest in varnashram as varnashram. But what we're interested in is that because we may not be able to just go in one fell swoop. Some people can, by the way. There are some people who just, their pure bhakti just takes off. And they just go like this so quickly that they practically don't need to dovetail anything. You know, and that's really cool if that happens to you. But for most of us, it's this gradual and proportional thing. So for most of us, we take what's really something external and material, which is varnashram, and that's like our pot, and we put it on the fire. But you got to have the bhakti. If you don't have the fire, the pot's not going to get hot. So you put the pot on the fire, and then that way the pot gets hot. So that's our scientific system. We should never think that the system of varnashram is what's purifying us. What's purifying us is bhakti. If you think varnashram is purifying you, then that's karma-covered bhakti. So the dovetailing of our propensities, that's not really what's purifying us. It's bhakti that's purifying us. And because we have bhakti, we are able then to offer everything in the fire of bhakti. In which case, it becomes as if it was bhakti. So if I'm working in a bank and offering everything to Krishna, that becomes the same as if I'm chanting Hare Krishna. It acts like fire. It will have the same effect. So that's the general principle. I'm not giving right now specifics of how to do it. I'm not giving any details, I'm just giving the principle of it. You see, honesty is a really good thing, by the way. To be truthful, if you want to be with the absolute truth, it's a really good idea to be truthful. Yes?
Yes.
Yes. Today actually is the appearance day of Raghunath Das Goswami. And in his wonderful book, Manashiksha, the main thing he talks about is throwing out deceitfulness. So truthfulness is really nice. Be truthful and say, at least to yourself and God, you don't have to put it in your blog, you know, but at least to yourself, I have these particular material emotions and desires and tendencies. Good start. Instead of, I'm fully spiritual when you're not. So this is the stuff I still have. It's still okay. Now I look in the, I go to sadhu, shastra, and guru. What does a person with these propensities and these desires and these emotions, how do they dovetail it? What's the core, what's the yajna you do if you want to enjoy in this way? For every kind of enjoyment, there's a yajna. There's a corresponding yajna. If you don't do the yajna, you're stealing. That's vikarma. So you do the yajna, but you don't do the yajna as a karmi, and you don't even do the yajna as a karma yogi. You do the yajna as a bhakti yogi, and you offer the yajna to Krishna. And then after you offer the yajna to Krishna, you enjoy what you get as prasadam. Get that? Everybody got that? Okay? So you take, this is the way I want to enjoy. Honest. You don't have to be honest. Do what you like, but it really helps if you're honest. If you want to enter the truth, you've got to be truthful. And Krishna knows anyway, you know, it's not like you're fooling anybody but yourself, and probably your friends know too. Probably everybody knows anyway. Who we're trying to kid with this stuff. So just be honest, and you go to Krishna, right? Akama sarva kama moksha kama dharati. Krishna, okay, I'm developing my spiritual emotions, and I do feel something when I read about you in Kali's coils, and I do feel something when I read about you giving butter to the monkeys, and I do feel something when I hear about you driving Arjuna's chariot, and I do feel something in the kirtan, and I feel something when I see the deities, but I also feel this other stuff. Okay, let's look at it. What kind of stuff is it? Is it strawberry stuff? Is it vanilla stuff? Is it butter pecan stuff? And what's the yajna I do? I want butter pecan. Okay. So the scripture said, if you want butter pecan, you have to pay this price. That's the price for the butter pecan. There's a different price for the strawberry. There's a different price. And you just look, you know. I want to be a kshatriya. Okay, be a kshatriya. Here's the price. Got to protect people. And got to protect people in the way you bring them to Krishna. And you've got to be willing to sacrifice everything to keep your word of honor. And you've got to be the first one on the battlefield. And you don't come back unless you're wounded. And, you know, this is stuff there. And you want to be a Vaishya. Then you've got to earn your money honestly. You've got to protect the land. You've got to protect the water. You've got to protect the air. You've got to protect the cows. You've got to, you know, give your like, a certain percentage to the Brahma, and so forth and so on. You've got to take care of your wife. You've got to tell her you love her. And you've got to tell her she's beautiful. Right? You got to serve the husband. You got to tell him he's a hero. That's the yajna. Okay, I want to enjoy a man taking care of me. Okay, and I got to tell him he's a hero. He doesn't look like a hero to me today. Right? That's the yajna. Is that clear? If you want to be in the brahmachari ashram and you want someone else to take care of you, and then you got to just do what you're told. That's the brahmachari ashram. That's not talking about lifetime brahmachari. Lifetime brahmachari can also be vanaprastha or sannyasa. But if you just want to live in the ashram and you get a place to live and you get your meals, and then you gotta do what you're told. Okay, Prabhu, it's 10:15. What are you doing? That's your yajna. And then you gotta engage in study. You have to take the energy upward to the brain and engage in study, and you don't engage in any income producing activities. You can't act in the world as a Shudra Vaishya or even as a Brahmin, if you're in the Brahmacharya, just study. Right? And you want to be a sannyasi, and you want to just travel and have freedom, and well, then you can't have your own bank account, and you can't have, you know, adoring members of the opposite sex. Oh, Myra, you know, you can't have that. That's your sacrifice. You can't have a control. You can't control where you live and what you're going to do and where you're going to stay. So each enjoyment, you have a corresponding sacrifice. And the karmi offers that sacrifice to the devas, or maybe even to Vishnu, with the idea of they're focused on enjoying the prasadam. The vikarmi just tries to steal the enjoyment without paying any sacrifice. The karma yogi says, okay, I'm just doing this out of duty, so I'll become liberated. And the bhakti yogi says, Krishna, I'm doing this for you. Krishna, when I tell my husband he's a hero, I'm trying to please you, Krishna, not my husband. When I treat the customers at the bank or I work nicely, I'm trying to please you, Krishna, not my bank employee. And whatever you give me, Krishna, I accept as your prasadam. If you let me you know, have some of the material enjoyment that I'm hankering for in your service, I accept that as prasadam. And if you trample me, I accept that as your prasadam too. And gradually, by doing that, you fall in love with the person for whom you're sacrificing. And gradually, you don't care any much about the enjoyment for what you, it just doesn't matter anymore. And then it becomes more, Krishna, where do I fit in your service rather than where do I want to enjoy? It gradually changes into something else by the power of your Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam. So that's a bit of a long answer, but I hope that was that helpful? Okay, again, it was mostly principle. I think for detail, you really have to work with some guide. That's, of course, the idea of guru, that you work with some guide, that you can be honest with that person. It's really important to have at least one person in your life you can be honest with, that you can say, these are my desires, and this is how I want to enjoy, and these are my attachments, without shame. And then the person can say, oh, okay, this is how to do it. This is how to use it. And what's really nice is if you use it properly, then they don't bother you anymore, those things. They're really nice. They cease to be a disturbance. And if one does it properly, then Bhagavad Gita 4:24, one's whole life merges into transcendence. So for the thief, their pleasure is also suffering. Isn't it? The person who tries to steal enjoyment without paying any sacrifice. Then they can't even enjoy because they're always afraid they're going to get caught. For the karmi, their sacrifice is still... For the vikarmi, their whole life is just sacrifice. Mode of ignorance is no happiness. Just suffering. I mean, there's some kind of weird happiness. I'm so evil, you know, but that's a funny thing. And the person in the mode of passion, the karmi, their suffering is suffering. And their happiness is illusory. So there's a little bit of illusory happiness and suffering. For those in the mode of goodness, although they're working for purification, they get to have some real happiness. And for those in transcendence, the sacrifice is also blissful. It's as much fun to cook for Krishna as it is to eat the prasadam, isn't it? Yes. So in Krishna consciousness, in the proper consciousness, the sacrifice becomes as enjoyable as the prasadam. And everything becomes enjoyment. But to do that, you have to be honest about where you are materially and dovetail properly. So what happens if you're not honest about your material desires, you're not honest about your material emotions, you won't dovetail them properly. They don't go away. They'll go away eventually, but in the meantime, they'll cause you a lot of trouble. And they may impede your bhakti. Bhakti alone is sufficient. You don't really need to do anything else other than bhakti. Everything else will go away if all you do is bhakti. Even if you don't dovetail your material things, bhakti is sufficient. But boy, it helps. It really helps. Therefore, Prabhupada encouraged it, not because it's necessary, but because it's helpful. You know, things will go much more smoothly. And there's always a risk if you don't dovetail that stuff that it will cause you some kind of trouble with your dealings with the other devotees and so forth and so on. And you may try to get those desires fulfilled in an improper way, and they may even entangle you in sinful activities and so forth and so on, and actually become an impediment to bhakti. So I do think we need to end out. Thank you very much. All glories to Shiva.